Good morning, everybody. Welcome to the July 21st Traffic Safety Commission meeting. And I think we have a very fruitful agenda ahead of you today, and we have new members at the table. So on the phone, I want to acknowledge Matt Severi from NHTSA is on the phone.
You there, Max?
Yes, thanks.
Yeah.
And I also want to start off by acknowledging that this will be Sandy Mullen's last meeting. And I just want to acknowledge and appreciate all the work that you have done for Department of Licensing, as well as I think many of the people around this table. It's going to be hard to see you go, being such a strong supporter of public safety. So we're going to miss you, Sandy, but you got a really great job there that I'm sure you're going to add a tremendous amount of value to. So congratulations. With that, we'll go ahead. We have two new commissioners that are joining us, Commissioner Pat Lashway and Commissioner Rosemary Cipolla. Mm-hmm. And if the two of you would like to just give maybe a brief introduction of yourself, that would be great. Okay. You want to start, Pat?
Sure. Good morning. So I am the Acting Secretary for Department of Social and Health Services. I've been in the department 28 years, so I think they picked me because, you know, I know where all the bones are buried. So, thank you for allowing me to join you, and I apologize for my periodic and frequent attendance. There's just a lot going on in our mental health system, and there are some people here around the table who are helping me greatly on that. Thank you for welcoming my team also to all of the projects that we do contribute to around traffic safety, and we really appreciate the partnership with many, many of you. Thank you.
Thanks, Pat. Rosemary?
Rosemary Cipolla. I live in Kalama, Washington. I'm the city council, so I'm doing the AWC slot for the commission. I'm retired. I was a transportation planner for 25 years with the city of Portland, Oregon, and then with the Kalispell Council of Governments. So I covered the southwest corner of the state, Kalispell, Wakayama, Pacific, and Grays Harbor County. So I'm very familiar with transportation planning and policy issues. Kind of been in the fight for years, and I'm really looking forward to representing the cities on the commission.
Awesome. And I also understand, Alan Jones, this is your last meeting too?
Yes.
So I want to thank you for your service to the commission, and we're going to miss seeing you at our meetings as well. I think, sure. You know, being part of the Traffic Safety Commission since 2013, I truly enjoy the meetings and just appreciate all that you've done to help us move forward with traffic safety-related issues. And I'm sure Darren echoes some of that. All right. So we have an internal staff person that's new to your team, Darren. Do you want to introduce her, or do you want her to introduce herself?
Geneva, would you like to stand? As you know, we had our FARS analyst retire, and Geneva Hawkins came over from the Department of Transportation. We were very fortunate. Thank you very much, Department of Transportation, for letting us steal her, but it was a legal theft. So she comes in as a transportation planner, specialist three, coming in. So she'll be working in the FARS unit as a FARS analyst, and we're very excited to have her. So Stacy is the supervisor. Do you want to say anything real quick?
No, I just echo what Darren says. We're very fortunate to have Geneva and all her experience. And if it's okay, Geneva, you want to take 30 seconds to just talk about what that experience is?
Okay.
You've got to stand.
Oh, 16 years at DOT working in the crash data and analysis branch. Was coding crashes of all severities for years. In the last 11, I've done the reporting out, and I am excited to be here. Father who died in a fatal car wreck, and this is near and dear to my heart. And this office I've worked with them for 11 years, you know, externally, and it's an amazing group, and I'm excited to be here.
Thank you. So, with Geneva, back here is Terry Cotton. If you want to just say hello.
Hi.
They make up our FARS unit, and sometimes I feel like, you know, they may be kind of that hidden gem that's in the agency. They do a tremendous amount of work for us, and between the two and the collaboration, it's going to be a great team. So we're excited to have them both here, so with us. So thanks for being here and part of this.
All right. With that, we'll move on to approval of the April 21st, 2016 minutes.
So moved.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Okay, minutes have been approved. Or any objections, I should ask. Next, we'll move on to an update on the project partnership, and this is Mark that's going to do a presentation on leveraging and enhancing alcohol countermeasures to reduce drug driving.
Hi, I'm Mark McDowell, and I'm one of the impaired driving program managers here at the Traffic Safety Commission, and hopefully I won't even take 5 minutes on this. We just wanted to make sure that everybody was aware. We were contacted a few months back by Texas A&M University, their Transportation Institute. They call it TTI. It's a mouthful. They do research projects all over the country on many different road safety projects. Everything from teen driving. Some of you guys may be aware of them. They have a great research team. We were honored that they asked us. They contacted us. At first I thought, well, of course, we're under the microscope because we have legalized marijuana now. We're one of those few states. But they actually are doing a national study of impaired driving countermeasures looking at alcohol-related incidents. So they said they know that obviously there's drug impairment as well, but only a few states were chosen. So on August 9th, it's a Tuesday, we're going to be up at the Criminal Justice Training Commission in Burien. They wanted between 20 and 25 subject matter experts. They wanted the variety similar to what we have on our Washington Impaired Driving Advisory Council. So we basically used that list, and I sent them kind of some contacts from that list and let them kind of make a decision from there. They wanted representatives in law enforcement. They wanted subject matter experts from law enforcement, judicial, prosecutors, prevention, treatment, traffic safety, so licensing, the whole gamut of kind of the subject matter experts. And so, like I said, we're one of the few states that have been chosen to do this. They're scheduling it for anywhere from 6 to 8 hours. They said we don't want to say it's 6 hours and cut you guys off if you're having good conversations. Some of you might be aware of this. Your offices have already been contacted. The invitations have already been sent out. They said they've gotten great response. If anybody, I'm not going to go into great detail. If anybody's interested as far as who may be representative from your agency or your backgrounds, things like that, I'd be glad to share the list with you. We do have probably 17 people, I think as of yesterday, confirmed. Others are still checking their schedules. But it's a great thing to be involved in. They will be sending out, Texas A&M will be sending out the questions, the survey questions, kind of some of the topics they'll be covering throughout the day, sending that out to us soon, and so we'll do our best to get that to all the commissioners just to keep you guys updated on that, and then hopefully we'll have the results here in a couple months, and we can share that with you as well, send that out. Any questions on that? What's going on with that? Okay, thanks.
Thank you, Mark. Okay, we'll move on to the next item on the agenda, which is distracted driving policy and legislation with Shelley.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome, new commissioners. Happy to have you guys here. As you know, we currently have a distracted driving law that is difficult to enforce and a little difficult for people to understand. Talking on the phone, holding it to your ear is definitely not allowed, but if you're holding it here or between your fingers, that's fine. Texting is not allowed, that's for sure, but courts have ruled that everything else that you could be doing, interacting with your cell phone, surfing the web, Snapchatting, taking pictures, videotaping, all of that is usually not enforceable. So we've been searching for an upgrade to the law to make it clear for people who understand and to help law enforcement be able to enforce the law because, of course, if someone's holding the phone here, it's very difficult for them. And texting is, you know, you have to prove that they were texting and not emailing. So it's crazy. We've asked for legislation, and other people have asked for legislation 3 years in a row now to upgrade the law, have not been able to get it through. So this, at this point, we're taking a little bit of a different tact. Our agency itself said, We should have a distracted driving policy that really models the best practice around cell phone and driving use. So we are looking at a policy that acknowledges that the phone conversation and the text conversations are a two-way street. So we have said, if you know that that person that you want to reach is traveling, then do not call them, do not text them. If you need to stay in touch, arrange before they leave for how you're going to accomplish that. So you're not interfering with their driving. We know when that phone buzzes, it's really hard, especially if you think it might be the office and people expect you to work. So we're just being very clear. We do not expect you to conduct work while you're driving. We expect you to drive. And then the other part of it is when you're driving a state vehicle, no cell phone use at all. When you're using a state cell phone, no driving and using that phone. When you're driving your personal vehicle, no driving and conducting state business on your phone. So we just want it to be very, very clear that the safest thing to do is to keep that phone away while you're driving. And that our expectation is that you'll do that, and that our expectation is that we don't expect you to be feeling like we expect that you respond every single time somebody from work is trying to contact you. So that's our part. The discussion part I want to have today is we are also going to approach the governor's office with an idea that we suggest other agencies also make a distracted driving policy that is more inclusive, of more protective of the workforce than the state law. So I've told you what we're doing, but I would like your input on what you think we should ask for in a governor policy recommendation. So our recommendation to the governor. Should it be like ours, which is no cell phone use? Or, you know, should it just be kind of what we would like to get in the law, which would be no handheld use? And if such a thing were to go through, it would affect your agencies and your workforce. So I am hoping that you could provide me some insight on how you feel about that.
I think whatever we can do to encourage state employees to model a good example for the rest of society is a good thing. Even for us as a law enforcement agency, we're exempt. I still made it mandatory that we be hands-free as an agency when the law was first introduced. So I think it's our job to model good policy.
Any other thoughts? What about Alan?
We just put in place a WAC to prohibit the use of any use personal use of mobile communication devices for school bus drivers. So it doesn't matter whether it's hands-free or not, or watch-free.
Right. Yeah, I think that's great. So in terms of other OSPI pieces, would you have a problem with no use? You don't want to speak for OSPI. So I do also want to encourage you to send me an email if there's something that occurs to you later, but I would like more into it.
I know we have a policy on it. I'm not sure to what extent it goes, whether it's a hands-free policy. I believe that's where we are, but we can certainly send that to you.
Do you think it's more restrictive than the law?
I need to check on that.
Okay. So most, when I look at other policies, most policies about driving and work vehicle are follow the laws. You know, we expect you not to.
I know it's at least that, but I'm not sure that it goes further.
Encapsulates it all, so we don't make a separate policy that says anything about cell phones or seatbelts because we're expecting all that. But since we're asking for more strict, that's where I'm interested. Where would you guys be comfortable within that continuum of, okay, just be hands-free and work-related, we don't want you doing it.
Well, I think you said some other things, too, that I don't believe are in our policy, the discouraging and the making arrangements ahead of time, those kinds of things.
Yeah, and
seem applicable as well.
I think that, it's just that acknowledgement that there's a two-way thing happening. Mm. And we see it with young drivers and cell phone use that often the reason they're picking up their phone while they're driving is because it's their parent. You know, so it's kind of making that connection between, you have a responsibility too, you know your kid's driving, don't be trying to reach onto that phone.
I would imagine that ours says what the law says, but I'll look at that. But I kind of agree where Chief's going with it. As state employees, we need to role model it, and this really is going to take up cultural change like seatbelts. And so I think you kind of have to look at how do we get that cultural change.
So I almost wonder, in an executive order, it can be pretty directive as far as, thou shalt do this now, and this is how it should look. It should be modeled after this policy. Or it can be, set a direction that you intend, the governor intends to have state agencies model the behavior we want to see in the general public. And we want to work together to ensure that we're sticking to certain tenets within that policy. I think the only, and there's a benefit to that in giving a little more time if you said we want you to work together there, because this idea of creating some responsibility on leadership and managers and supervisors, that just because I'm in the car driving for 6 hours doesn't mean I can be on conference calls during that time. That's going to be the bigger shift, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And so kind of if we want to be sort of directive, one hit, make, a bold statement, or do we really want to change culture, and how does that, are we really talking to from the cabinet members down about what that looks like to change that expectation, to really change your behavior within your agency? And so I think we should have some consideration and certainly trying to talk about that. Do you want one, thou shalt do this, or do you want more of we want to have a working group to figure out what those parameters look like, a commitment, whatever that might be, and then set a date certain that everyone shall have a policy based on the model policy, because there's probably always going to have to be some exceptions based on the work of whomever in the agency, if it's someone that does have some responsibility to take emergency calls or something, or check in if they're dispatched somewhere. But still, that you could say they need to pull over. But, so I think looking at the shape of that, is it future state, is it right now, that is important.
Yeah, and I think the law pretty much addresses those circumstances. Emergency calls are allowed to be made. For us and others who are emergent in nature in terms of what we do, as Sandy speaks to, hands-free should be that goal.
Yeah.
It's not married, no use, but hands-free. Because the law calls for that.
The continuum that I'm thinking of. Because we could say hands-free and have very few reasons to make any exceptions.
Right.
It's so easy to be hands-free now. It's inexpensive. It's... and hands-free, we are eliminating the physical distraction of holding the phone and the visual distraction of looking to punch numbers into it.
You're saying take that away as well, right? The policy is saying no.
The policy would say no use. I mean, it could. So that's the continuum. We want you to be hands-free to we don't want you to use it at all.
I was coming back from Ellensburg Friday, spent 2.5 hours getting, or 3 hours getting from Federal Way to Olympia. And I have hands-free integrated into the vehicle and had a call or two. And it'd be nice to have a policy that recognized the fact that if you're sitting there at half a mile an hour, it's a little different than if you're at freeway speed. Well, I guess that was freeway speed.
That was freeway speed.
That's normal freeway speed.
Yeah.
Well, that's true. But the risk involved is different. But I'm not sure how you put that into a policy.
That's what our current law has, which is if you're stopped, you at a stoplight or a stop sign or in traffic, you can dial your phone and text and talk on it. Our current law accommodates that. And I'm not talking about personal use, right?
Yeah.
So we're not talking about what somebody does in their own car, with their own phone, on their own time. That's not something we can control. But we're talking about setting that example.
I was going to say, coming from the west or the east side of the state, we have the problem of people driving too fast and using their phones. But I recently brought all of this up. I do quite frequently when I go to what we call LEPC, which is our local emergency planning committee, and we meet with different cities and talk about hazards within their area and how we would respond, and we talk about general safety issues, and I quite frequently bring up things that we've talked about here in traffic safety. But one of the things that came out of that, we were talking about the hands-free and how we really need to encourage our employees to do this, and I'm talking out of, you know, the private sector as well. We have a couple of factories or industries over in the Moses Lake area that absolutely forbid their employees to use the phones while they're in a moving vehicle that's owned by the company. They have a system set up where they can give a tone to the phone that says, you know, when you get a chance, pull over and call the office. Or they have a system set up so that they know whether it's something that can wait or something that needs to be taken care of. To me, that's, you know, sometimes that's probably driven a little bit by insurance. Sometimes when we're going to write legislation, that comes on awfully hard, and then you're going to have people lined up at the in Olympia, you know, how they are with the helmet laws and that kind of thing. So I don't know. Maybe we should. I think that we that have the ability to influence what our employees do, like at the county, like at the state, you know, we can write that policy. Private, not necessarily so, but I think the companies are now seeing that this is very,
so
very,
you know, those
important.
Those texting commercials where the woman is in the car with the baby in the back seat and she just glances for just a second and bam. I think that the insurance companies are coming out, and I think we can nanny this to death, or we can, I think, like the chief said, we can make it an overall goal that everybody model good common sense behavior. But is there any way we could put things up in the like the rest areas and other places where people are kind of standing around reading where they are, and gently remind them, please don't drive and text? And we passed all that. Is that not effective? Are we not? We're not going to do any legislature. Are we kind of giving up on that this session, or are we just trying to tweak it and apply it to the state agencies?
There are legislators that are interested in still taking the legislation forward.
Okay.
So we won't submit agency requests because we don't want two bills
right
competing for attention out there. We'll let the legislator take the lead on that.
Are we satisfied with what they have in their language?
We would be happy with anything that makes it a lot easier to enforce and clearer for people.
Okay.
So, I mean, we're not asking for a whole lot. We're just
right
asking for law clarification. The law was passed in 2007.
Yeah, before all this technology
before
got
we had
even
this
greater
technology. So the only thing you could do was press A,
right,
you know, or
five
one
times,
three times,
right,
to press C,
right,
you know, remember that? I never did it, so I don't know. But
we have carpal tunnel, a lot of us.
Right, yeah, trying to do that while you were driving.
And
when cell phones came out, that was really their promise, right, was they were going to be this huge time saving because you could get your work done and your commute was now profitable.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that's the attitude we're trying to change now, is to say, no, driving needs to be about driving.
So if I could just add a couple pieces here, and Shelley's really been championing this, that when you look at what the efforts that have been made legislatively, it passed through the Senate, and then it's got held up in the House. I guess, again, this year we'll see, hopefully we'll see both the Senate and the House version is what our hope is, so we have companion bills going through. But beyond that is, if we can do some things just on our side from the state agency perspective, from executive government being able to push this out, is that helps to send to another message. This is really important. We're losing too many kids. We're losing too many people in our communities to distracted driving. The data itself, people would say, well, you know, we don't have a lot of data on it. We know that the data is way underreported. Lots of issues around that. But the fact of the matter is we're losing people. We need to take some measures to be able to correct that. And this is one area I think that we can, you know, we hear from the public, and it's, the fine should be $1,500, people should go to prison, and it's like, no, you know, but that's kind of that feel from the public in some respects. And so you start seeing some areas here of how do we help to message this? If it's that important, then we as state government need to make that important. And I think that this is a kind of that good step forward in making some of that cultural shift that we need. So.
And hopefully modeling it for companies who are also modeling it for us. And a lot of
I think the insurance is driving a lot of the company stuff.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. In terms of L&I claims, driving is at the top of the list of why states take out L&I.
You know, I think, Shelley, one of the things that would help, you know, I know we're seeking some adjustments to the current law, but until we're able to get there, if we can just simply remind state employees of what the current law calls for, it is our expectations that they comply with that law, particularly when operating a state vehicle. And that law calls for hands-free.
No. Our current law doesn't call for hands-free.
Right.
That's the problem.
Well, but you're not there. And you've got a lot of folks who are not complying with the current law. So if we can at least get them to comply with the current law, and as we make the next step, it's easier to bring them along in terms of getting them to accept the culture that we live within now.
And that really kind of goes back to their supervisors and everything.
Absolutely.
So we don't expect them to be 24/7 beck and call. I mean, it's, we're our own worst enemies.
It's kind of like taking one bite at a time of the elephant.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So could in the language of the executive order, though, you could talk about, because I think it is, this is a reach for people to get their head around that even hands-free, is that hands-free is not safe. And so I think that's a bigger, you know, we want to, one, say we need you guys to get, we want hands-free, let's all comply with the current law, and let's all comply with the current state policy and rules, which comply with the state law. Remind them of that, and then... But recognize somewhere in the language of the executive order the research that says you cannot, even hands-free does not keep you safe, and that is still distracted driving. And with SET, we could have an ultimate goal to go, you know, free of hands-free or free of zero distraction driving or whatever we want to call that. Because I do think that's a leap for folks because I'm on my Bluetooth. I'm not paying attention. And that is going to be that's the biggest cultural shift there. So is there a way to cue that up as the long-term goal? Get everyone up to speed and get that reminders out you can figure out what that looks like of, you know, a email to state employees or notices in the state fleet or something you sign every time you check out a fleet car, whatever that might look like. And then we work towards getting off of hands-free, and maybe have this is where you could probably have a few agencies such as yourself that are trying this and making that, you know, that distraction-free commitment or whatever that looks like. And we continue to add on to the agencies that understand what that means. Everyone's made that commitment to not set meetings while people are in the car. And then they sign on to as part of that. Or something that gets us there without people completely either just saying they're doing it and not doing it, or
something.
Technologies
we have
to continue
to reach.
Yeah, exactly,
before we can go there. So I'm tagging on to what Sandy is offering. I think some aspirational statement is really appropriate. I guess what worries me a tad bit about that is that there will have to be exceptions. It's hard for me to even envision Child Protective Services not being able to be called anytime they are anywhere. That's just a critical service that we provide. So then I get a little worried about you starting to carve into there's this exception and there's that exception and blah, blah, blah. I think for our organization, going hands-free will be a big jump. And the right one. I think we can get there. It means some people are going to have to become much more technology savvy than they probably are. We're just now moving even into having iPhones for instance, our children's caseworkers. So I see some, you know, long-range opportunity there. Mm-hmm. And again, I worry about once you have to start carving in exceptions, because we will have to do that. We can't. I think that's just a necessary part of our being able to be responsive under our current staffing patterns.
What did you do before cell phones?
Pagers. Mm-hmm. And in fact, in some of our areas, we're still stuck with pagers. So, and that's destructive driving too. So I think there's a lot of education that could go with that, but there are areas of our business that are not unlike the chief's, where you just absolutely have to have a way to communicate with your staff. And we do already encourage people, of course, to pull off and blah, blah. Then there's the other little part of me that thinks, wow, this could be a vacation. I could actually travel to Seattle without a conference call. This could be. Because I don't know about all of you, but I do a tremendous amount of work when I'm not in the office. That's the reality of the world we live in.
No, you can really enjoy traffic and
exactly.
The radio.
Yeah.
Is there a requirement in the state fleet cars now that they be Bluetooth compatible?
Not a requirement.
And I don't know because there are people using them. So. But I was thinking on that lines too. Could you
just
keep those disposable headsets or something in the car? I mean, is there a way that you're constantly making it easier to use hands-free?
But I would think coming along, there has to be just a basic thing like park and reverse and everything that is Bluetooth.
Most of the new cars are migrating to that.
But even earbuds could be a solution to that.
I mean, that might be something when DSHS orders cars, or I know a lot of your guys use their own cars and things. Bluetooth required.
And we provide the troopers Bluetooth because we expect them to take care of those emergency calls, so we give them the Bluetooth. And that helps a lot.
Yeah, that agrees.
Now, whether or not all of them are using them, that's a different story.
Yeah, I think hands-free is kind of a nice little step. It's kind of clear. It's kind of easier than you think if you're not already there.
Especially because it's a cultural shift.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And it moves us one little notch at a time to where we get where we need to. I think you begin with the end in mind and what you need, and then you kind of look at how we can do that incrementally. I think that's another aspect to just consider.
Yeah.
So.
Well, we will continue having discussions with you and with other agencies as we decide what we're going to craft and keep you guys informed of what we come up with. And I really appreciate your input because it's important for me to hear that whole perspective.
Thank you, Shelley.
Thank you.
So next up we have Cynthia Harry, and talking about the, I think the acronym is RINO program, right?
Yes, that's correct. So she pulled up the presentation. I'll be talking about the syndromic surveillance legislation that we're proposing to go forward for this 2017 legislative session. This is the Rapid Health Information Network, which houses our syndromic surveillance data within the state of Washington at the Washington State Department of Health. And so if we go on to the next slide. So our proposal is, of course, to mandate syndromic surveillance reporting specifically for emergency room departments within the state of Washington. I don't know if most of you are familiar with what syndromic surveillance data is, but syndromic surveillance data is near real-time data reporting from emergency room departments and eligible providers' healthcare facilities across the state of Washington. Near real-time, meaning this data is coming directly from the electronic health records that the facilities keep and is transferred over to our system through the health information exchange within every 5 minutes of record being entered within the EHR. That record then comes into the system and updates longitudinally throughout the patient's visit. So initially with chief complaint in regards to somebody walking in for the reason of their visit and leading with a discharge diagnosis. So currently, syndromic surveillance is being used within the state of Washington to investigate, respond to, and plan around emerging communicable disease and chronic disease events. Previously, this system was developed in the early 2000s as a response to bioterrorism events associated with the World Trade Towers and a lot of the anthrax U.S. Postal Service mailing services. It has become more of a robust system outside of the bioterrorism aspects of using this system for detecting bioterrorism events associated with communicable diseases. At the state, we use it for situational awareness in regards to emergency response preparation. We use it for detecting notifiable conditions that are unreported through our healthcare providers and labs. And there are several interests across the state to utilize this data for various purposes, including for monitoring injuries. A little bit of history about the data that we're currently receiving. The data that we receive is what we call meaningful use level data. This is data that is currently funded for healthcare facilities, including emergency room departments by the federal government under CMS, or the Center for Medicaid Services, to provide data to public health for this purpose exactly. That funding is aligned to go until 2021, and then after that funding, the federal government is no longer available, then facilities will no longer be receiving incentive money to carry out reporting for public health purposes under meaningful use. We currently have 92 emergency room departments within the state of Washington reporting this data to us, and over 2,500 urgent care clinics and other inpatient outpatient clinics across the state of Washington are reporting data through this syndromic surveillance platform within the state of Washington. So what is the value of this data for Washington Traffic Safety Commission? This is the only source of emergency room department within the state of Washington. It's a real-time data source, meaning it's data that's current. We can keep up to date with all of the visits that are coming into our emergency room departments and urgent care clinics within the state of Washington. We get discharge diagnoses so we can identify what is the true nature of their visit. We also get complaints in regards to what are their chief complaints, what are they coming in for. We envision that this system can help, along with a lot of the other data that the Washington Traffic Safety Commission already gathers, in identifying the true burden of traffic-related injuries within the state of Washington, specifically looking at minor injuries that may not be reported through traffic-related data. So the issue is why we're proposing this legislation so immediately, knowing that funding will be in alignment until 2021. Is that in 2017, meaningful use funding transitions to the third phase, the third and final phase for reporting. So this means that in phase three, facilities are no longer required to report syndromic surveillance data to public health. A lot of other state health agencies have pushed forward legislation, and seven have passed legislation around syndromic surveillance reporting to assure that these robust systems that we've developed to collect this data are maintained. This is data that we are already receiving, so it's not like we're asking facilities to do more than they're already capable of doing. It's just making sure we continue to receive these data sources after phase three is implemented in 2017. So this is just a little bit more information. So with that, I will open it up for any questions or concerns in regards to this legislative proposal for requesting emergency room department data within the state of Washington.
So, Darren, as we look to identify our number of injury and serious injury collisions, do you look at this as something that's being helpful to us?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Just give a quick overview. So I run the data integration project for Traffic Records Coordinating Committee. It's been an ongoing effort that's been occurring for over a decade now, and Washington State has never had emergency department data. We have the trauma registry, and we have hospital inpatient discharge data. And the previous pilot studies we did with the integration of the crash records showed that when officers are assessing minor injuries, some of them end up in trauma, which from the clinical standpoint are serious injuries, and vice versa. We also have officer-reported serious injuries that never have an associated hospital visit. So there's also some disconnect in how it's defined for the officers to assess it versus how a clinician or a medical perspective would define that. So just like we found that in the trauma data, when we get ED data, we expect the same thing, that we're going to see officers reporting minor or no injuries, but the ED record may show something else, more along the lines of seriousness. So, yes, this has been a huge data gap in Washington State for a long time, and it's an amazing opportunity to leverage a very, very important surveillance system to the outbreak piece of Department of Health and also contribute to chronic and injury prevention, which is more our side of the house.
So as those discrepancies are pointed out after the fact, are the troopers, officers going to be expected to submit supplemental reports?
Nope.
Good.
Nope. In fact, you know what the idea would be? Is not to have the officers assess injury at all.
That's good.
So I think, you know, as Stacey has articulated, is this data integration piece of being able to look at all these various sources that we can actually use to marry up all of the different sources, and it can be used for all of our partners. And I think it's with this particular data, it doesn't come with personal identification information.
So we do collect identifiable information with this data. So that's one of the benefits of meaningful use data, is there's a plethora of information that we can collect and capture. So there is the potential that we could link this data with the other data that DOH collects. And we're currently working on a process within our agency to look at that data infrastructure and architecture, but also I'm hoping that can benefit the Washington Traffic Safety Commission as well. Now, we're not releasing that information in our external user interface where we have users access that data, but we do have the back-end database that has patient identifiers along with medical record numbers, so there could be follow-up, and that's what public health generally uses it for notifiable conditions. Investigations will do follow-up based off of that medical record number with the infection practitioners within the hospital facilities.
So they would have an ID number that could be married up to a crash report without having to have that personal information?
Yes, so that's correct. So we would discuss what data sharing agreement terms would be in place with the Washington Traffic Safety Commission in order to do sort of this alignment with the other data, the trauma and the WMSIS and the CHARS data that is currently being captured by this integration effort.
So just to be clear on our end, obviously there has to be strong governance in place when we're dealing with hospital identifiers. But on the flip side of that, we have to have those to do this. We can't integrate this data on our side without the identifiers provided by the Department of Health. So as Cynthia said, there's MOU processes in place. The Department of Health has already entrusted us with their discharge data and their trauma data. We do handle it more carefully. We take just the identifiers separate from the hospital record to do just the linkage part. We destroy all that, create an ID like you talked about, and then get the hospital record to do the analysis. So even if we wanted to release this data, we make it kind of impossible for even us to do that.
So is this a national initiative?
Integrated traffic records has been for a very long time. From Cynthia's perspective, meaningful use does make it a national effort on that side as well.
Well, we've talked about this as a need, though, from the International Association of Chiefs of Police standpoint. We want to actually capture this data nationally.
Mm-hmm.
This would be very helpful.
Yeah, so there are in regards to emergency room department data, there are national efforts, and then there are state and local efforts to capture this information. So, of course, our local initiative is trying to mandate this so we can continue and sustain reporting. There have been federal funds in alignment since 2011, and that goes until 2021 to support locals and states bringing on this data source. There's also a national syndromic surveillance platform, which uses the similar tools that we use locally to look at a national perspective, more data-gated perspective of what's going on with emergency room departments within the state of Washington. But there are also several conversations at the national level of what other data sources can be integrated with this robust data to capture a more fine-tuned picture of what's going on, maybe not only for the public. Just to give you some context, this system started out in the VA and DOD and then was released to public health to utilize. So there's a lot of utility for the system outside of the public health framework and state and local just coming to that understanding and trying to figure out how we can utilize this data to support other activities outside of the Department of Health.
So is the what I'm hearing this, what, why we would the interest in this is to sharpen our accuracy of the data that we have?
The true burden of the traffic safety effect on the public health system. So without that ED, we're missing a big chunk of hospital costs, hard dollar costs, not charges. We're missing potentially serious injuries that are classified as minor by officers and therefore aren't getting the weight or the review that they deserve as fatal and serious as officers classified them are. And as our pilots have shown, that classification of officers is a little bit off. So it really is a good opportunity to better focus our efforts on crashes that truly are serious crashes.
Well, yeah, again, the private sector in me says, is Big Brother watching here? You know, I mean, there's that balance that happens that when you start talking about identifying patients and so forth, that's kind of scary.
Yeah, and that's why we do have contingencies in place in the legislation to make sure that we are protecting the health information. It's only releasing the information in accordance with HIPAA, which are the national level perspectives for the level of information that we can release. It's not something that would be FOIA-able, not something that we could release to the general public. There are some strict regulations and rules that are set up and already in place in regards to how we can share that data and who that data can be shared with. This is something that we've been doing since 2003, is collecting this data and making sure that we have these rules in place to make sure that people can not be identified, and it's not Big Brother sort of overarching watching, and this information could be releasable. So that's up to us to make sure that we're looking at the integrity of the data and making sure that we're protecting that data from other individuals who may want to access it. This is more of a legislation to carry out continued activity to support our collection of that data. But I definitely hear where you're coming from about the scary idea of Big Brother watching.
Well, you could see happens. If you expanded it, where do you end? You know,
I think that's going to be the response of the legislature, too, frankly. Is that, and I think they're going to want to put those parameters into the legislation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
They're not going to trust any of our agencies, probably, frankly. I mean, I think that's what we've seen is in the legislature is a distrust of state agencies handling data, and there's probably some work you could do with WATAC and the Office of Privacy there to form that language. And I think also being really clear to articulate, if we support as a commission, being really clear as to for what purpose, and probably the same for any of the agencies, of for this purpose and being in some parameters around that purpose, because I do think that's, I feel that too when I hear it. And even if it's already been going on, then I think there's going to be a distrust of, what do you mean you were collecting this data for all this time?
Right.
Why didn't you know about it? And that further that sense of, okay, so the federal, because the federal government did it, makes people all the more suspicious right now.
Exactly.
Yeah, I think to ease any concerns about why law enforcement is interested, we're simply interested in raw data, no identifiers. We just want to know where our non-injury, injury, and serious injury and fatality collisions are occurring so that we can deploy resources accordingly.
Exactly.
The better we're able to pinpoint where our problems are and deploy the few resources we have, the more effective we can be in solving problems.
And, you know, that's our intent, too, is, like I said earlier, the only reason we need identifiers is to do the linkage. If DOH is successful in integrating their own data, which would be the EMS data, the trauma data, and the inpatient data, and we can get a de-identified record that we can then further continue the linkages with the traffic record systems, that, of course, is even a more stringent and more ideal situation to keep it in a single house as much as possible. In response to you, Sandy, I would love the legislature to be very clear on this.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's caused a lot of issues with data sharing in the past, in that it's not been clear, and it's been up to agencies to develop those security standards and interpret the intent of the legislature. So this is a good opportunity to hopefully see some of that clarity from the legislature.
And we do, again, we do have, just to connect the dots, we have a new Office of Privacy in WATAC, mm-hmm. and that's their whole goal, is to make sure that we can put those parameters and help all of our agencies figure out what that should look like. And they have a certain, I mean, they have a relationship with legislature, so there's some trust factor there maybe. So
we also have data sharing agreements, like with the private sector, and in our, and when they gave us the ability to do data sharing, it was very specific in statute on what the data could be used for, and then there were controls put in place to do audits to make sure that they're being used for the intended purpose, and certain security requirements in place that they had to ensure security audits were done to ensure that the data was kept secure.
We've been mimicking a lot of those processes as well in our conversations with the AG and with WATAC in regards to our legislative proposal. We've tried to align it as closely as possible with the CHARS legislation that has allowed the data to be releasable to Washington Traffic Safety per se, but there's definitely some caveats in there in regards to who's able to get access to direct versus indirect versus not either of those data sources. We have conversations in a work group currently working on redefining our data share agreements for internal and external. So even internally, it's hard for anybody to get access to this data unless there's a clear-cut reason and explanation of why they need access to this data. It's almost like a data chain of custody, like you have for a laboratory, you have a chain of custody. So for this data, it's like a chain of custody where you have to document where it goes and who has access to it and the reasons that they have access to that data, because of the reason that we don't want to give protected health information out to anybody. And if you're looking at syndromic surveillance data, it's a little bit different than CHARS data, because we are capturing this chief complaint element, and chief complaint is basically a pretext of whenever somebody walks into the ED, whatever they say is typed in, and there could be some sensitive information that's in that pretext form, so we're very careful about the information that we would release to the public. But yes, definitely some further conversations of how we would be able to integrate that with other data sets and release it to the public.
I can argue the other side of that as well.
I just
happened to think about a traffic stop that one of the Grant County deputies made the other day, and it was a routine stop for something. Who knows what it was? Speeding, I think, is what it was. And come to find out, the person behind the wheel was one of the people that was released, and there was a warrant out for him that was released early, one of the 3,000. Anyway, they captured him. And I was just thinking, well, gee, in a situation like, what if that person was in an accident, ended up in the hospital? Would that information emerge, and then it presents an opportunity to get bad guys off the street, if you see what I mean? So, like I said, I could talk both sides of this, but
it's just a rough name. I like the name. It's kind of a cool sounding name.
Right.
It sounds a little, it's got the word surveillance in it.
Yeah.
Syndromic surveillance is a little rough.
So that's why we've actually rebranded. I'm calling it syndromic surveillance because that's what most partners know it as, but we are now calling it the Rapid Health Information Network. We're moving away from the term syndromic surveillance.
Well, just the term surveillance
really
is bad.
Because the system really isn't what syndromic surveillance was intended
Star Trek
to be
just
anyway.
Came out,
and
well,
we've
really
heard from several stakeholders that's not a very friendly name. So
you can have an
now
actual,
it's the Rapid Health Information Network.
I like that.
You can actually have like a rhino image.
Yes.
We do have a logo that's in our DOH standards review group right now that is a rhino made out of ones and zeros. Very data.
Anything rhino is black ops spewed.
That's true.
This
rhino's smiling at us.
Yeah, right.
Transparent.
The rhino.
Yeah.
I'm not sure rhino's that hot, to be honest with you. All right.
Is there any other questions?
Thank you.
Okay. We're going to move on next to senior drivers, and this is Brady Hornstein is from Department of Licensing is going to do the presentation. Just wanted to say this presentation and research came out of a goal council meeting actually over a year ago, in which the governor asked some questions around senior drivers and their impacts to fatalities and serious injuries. And they are a very small percentage of the population, but it's expected to almost double by 2030, the population of 70-plus year-olds. It's also moved to a priority 2 in the upcoming Target Zero plan, which we'll talk about at the end here. And so there's been a bunch of research that we wanted to share with the group about what we've learned in this group of people.
Again, I'm Brady Hornstein with DOL, so thanks for having me here. We get more and more questions every day at DOL, like, what can we do about a parent or a grandparent? I know my 93-year-old grandpa just bought a brand new Buick, so I think he's going to continue to drive. It's not
green. It's probably green. No.
Is it autonomous?
That's right.
Purple.
So,
purple.
But he's very proud, so I don't think we're going to get him off the road. So, as Pat said, it's a growing population, and it's growing far more than the young adult population. Same period where we're going to grow by 71% is like 8% for 17 to 22. So the Washington population is going to get older over the next several years, and that just creates more awareness around this issue and more problems for law enforcement, for licensing agencies, and all of us in public health to deal with. So this gives you kind of an idea, and I wanted to kind of make sure we're all working on the same page. I think that's the tough part about this issue, is people have bad experiences with senior drivers on the road all the time, and it creates this sense, there's coverage in the media, horror stories, and we have this sense that it's this massive, scary problem that we have to put tons and tons of resources in. And while it's worth our attention, we just want to make sure that everybody's on the same page about really the size of the problem. So you can see in Washington, pretty much everybody has a driver's license between 25 and all the way, you know, almost to 65. And you can see it starts to taper off. So interestingly, these drivers are kind of removing themselves from the roadway anyway. You can see by the time 85 and up, only 54% of these people actually have a driver's license anymore. So lots of people are just not renewing anyway in Washington State.
But the boomers are going to be different.
Yeah, exactly. People don't believe this.
They don't believe anything.
So it's just an interesting. So when you think about policy options, just remember people are already willing to give up their driver's license by huge numbers. So this again shows the driving. Need to get that out of there. The collision counts by age. So this again provides some perspective. You can see the young drivers are still involved in far more collisions. These are all collisions. And then the 75 and up is 5,000. So that gives you some perspective. I mean, young drivers are still worth a lot more attention. You know, that's where a bulk of these things are happening. What's unfortunate is a senior driver, just due to their age and health conditions, the accident or the collision can be far more fatal or result in injuries, where a young driver, they walk away without any problems. So that's another place where it comes up. So this gives you a better idea of the rate, which again puts it in perspective. You can see per 100,000 licensed drivers is the blue line. So you can see the 16 to 24-year-olds at 16.2. And then if we come over here to the 75 and up, it's 9.6. So it's still lower. It starts to go up, though, for 75 and up. But it's still, it just gives you a sense of where things are. So there's definitely a problem to address, but again, I mean, it puts it in perspective, so it's good information to have. NHTSA, I think several years ago now, did a crash assessment on a little more, to get a little more understanding what types of collisions are happening. And they determined, kind of developed this crash involvement ratio. And, you know, this breaks down, you know, over, if you're over 80, you're four times more likely to be at fault in a collision. And that's, again, where the public perception comes in. Because if you are hit by a driver, it's very likely it's a senior driver in a lot of cases. So people just run with these experiences, and that's affecting public perception as well. But the really interesting thing from this assessment is the types of situations that senior drivers are getting, are having trouble in. So a young driver, it's impairment, speeding, bad choices. Senior drivers, it's more things like when they come to an intersection and they need to make a left turn and they misjudge the oncoming traffic and that leads to a collision. Or you have an intersection problem where they yield to merge and they don't yield properly. That's where another issue you hear from people all the time is, you know, they merged in at 10 miles an hour and they should be going faster. And you can see by age where these types of events happen. And for basically all drivers, you know, before 60s, mid-60s, it's all, you know, roughly pretty similar. But then you can see things like the signal left turn issue at time just jumps, skyrockets for senior drivers. And the same with the yield sign issue. That's that blue one here. So this is where, you know, unfortunately, this is just kind of a cognitive decline issue probably. I mean, there's not a whole lot we can do other than make sure these senior drivers are aware of this is what happens. Maybe there's some roadway engineering things, I don't know. But it's just very interesting and very stark to see this. So here are some key takeaways. Don't have a lot of time, but from our research. Washington's elderly population is growing, like I described. These drivers, 65 and over, make up 15% of the driving population, but account for 10% of the crashes. They have difficulties handling those intersections and left turns and those yielding maneuvers. Elderly drivers 65 and up, they routinely give up their license voluntarily already. And only 54% of those drivers 85 and over have a driver's license, compared to 100% effectively for 25 to 54. So when we looked at all this, we came up with some recommendations, which I'll show you here. And some of these we're working on. Some of them will require legislative changes. And I will say, a lot of people ask, what do we do currently? Well, one thing is, if you're 70 and up, you have to come into a DOL office every time you need to renew your license. So right now it's every other time, every other six-year interval for most drivers. So senior drivers, we've done that, so they come in. It gives a chance for staff to see if someone has a medical issue, maybe a vision test, things like that, to make sure they're safe to be on the road. But these are kind of some five key things that we've identified and research around the country has identified as well. So in turn, making sure our representatives at the licensing offices are trained to recognize medical issues and potential things, because we have the ability to require re-examinations if we see some things that cause concern. So we're going to do some more work around that.
Brady, we completed that in the in-service training this spring.
Yeah, and so we continue to emphasize it internally. And then providing education materials to family.
She has a question.
Would that include on the re-examination, going out with the DOL agent and driving?
Absolutely.
Yes.
Okay. Yeah, you can.
So it's not just the test, it's actual driving.
It really depends on the situation, but they can be retested or go through a re-exam of their driver's test.
Yeah.
the actual driving.
So if the daughter's standing behind the guy going, like this, they'll pick up on that?
And the big thing is with the aging population is I think it's a, for all of you with aging parents or grandparents, it's a tough conversation to have. It's a freedom thing. And so DOL, which has a lot of contacts with the public, we need to take more opportunities to help people have those conversations. AAA and other organizations, I think insurance companies have materials already, but we can continue as an agency to provide more information about that. Because it's a tough conversation. Like my grandpa, I'm going to make my dad do it. I'm not going to be the one to ask him to get off the road. But so those are just things that we need to work on and provide some more info. And then we can get into the legislative stuff, and these are tougher for a number of reasons. Some states offer a no-cost ID card. So many of you know you can get an ID card or a driver's license. So if you offer a no-cost ID card in exchange for your driver's license, so if you say, I'm 75 and I don't want to drive anymore, mm-hmm. you come to a DOL office, say, I want an ID card, and we'll give you one for free. That would require some legislative change. But that's a big thing. A lot of people say, I need my ID. I might as well keep my driver's license. So that's a big thing. And that's another opportunity to have communication with the driver. Then implementing shorter renewal cycles. So right now it's a 6-year renewal cycle. I talked about how they do have to come in, but some states, it's 3 years or goes to 2 years, or at some age, if you're 90 years old, maybe we want to see them every year or 2 years. So that's something for the legislature to think about. And then the big thing in Washington, which all of you, especially agencies, know, the Public Records Act is very strong. You can actually report a dangerous driver in Washington State. So if your dad's driving, or your patient, your doctor, your patient, you want to report them, you can. There's a form, and DOL will then review that, but that's public. And what happens is the driver will often call and say, who reported me? And we have to tell them. So that is not fun for family members, and it's definitely not fun for doctors, for their patient and customers. So one idea, and some states do this, and we've talked about it, it would require legislative work, but you could exempt that form from the Public Disclosure Act, and then maybe...
Good luck.
The idea is, fair enough, the idea is that more people would be willing to report without the fear of that. So,
kind of like Crime Stoppers.
Yeah, exactly.
So on 3, we also looked at a reduced cost driver's license, or I mean identification card. But we actually get a lot of requests for that, but we did not submit it because of the budget climate today. That would be a revenue impact, so that's something that is out there. And then the shorter renewal cycle is now, with our new drive system, when that goes in June of 18, we will have the ability to do shorter cycles. Right now, we can only do 6-year increments, so that there is capability then in technology for us to be able to do that.
So on 3, currently, if somebody came in and wanted to surrender their license and get an ID card, what does it cost now?
The same as a driver's license, which is, $54.
Can you credit, like if you have 2 years left on your license, is that credit towards the cost of the ID?
It's not prorated.
There would be, I think, a fee for a replacement card, and I think that's like $20. So we'd have to pay $20 to convert it to. So it costs money. And
it's not like huge. I mean.
But I think the issue that you hear from the LSRs, because when I was in service, every region was raising it, is that these are folks that are on limited income, and it doesn't make sense for them to relinquish their driver's license and have to pay the same amount for an identification card.
It's just punch a hole in it.
Yeah. A lot of times if you punch a hole in it, then there are banks and places that won't take it because
really?
Then they don't see it as a valid identification document.
That's
so you can't
bad.
Really...
Mm-hmm. Face
if
it.
There's some way, I mean, you can do some kind of a marker,
right.
though.
Well, we used to punch holes in certain fender type licenses years ago.
Yeah.
People with DUIs and that sort of thing, so the officers would know.
When people come in with a suspended license,
yeah.
we punch the hole in it, and
right.
there are people that come unglued.
Sure.
Yes.
You could just stamp old on it. That'd be popular too.
Yeah.
I actually think that you would motivate senior citizens to give up their driver's license if we had a reduced cost driver's license,
right.
Because many of them are keeping them for the purpose of identification.
Yeah.
And I also think that you would have people giving up their driver's license sooner, too, if they had a shorter cycle. Because many ask for, do I really have to have it for 6 years?
Mm-hmm. Yes, the messaging around it, the fact that we do this and we offer this, it helps encourage senior drivers to do this.
Well, you could do it like a graduated on the reverse end of it, like the kids are
yeah,
go back to a portrait and have it renewed every 2 years or something, and give him that one and say, okay, this means you've got to come back in 2 years. But, I mean, you could go to the other side and just make a whole circle with your whole graduated thing, just do it on the other end. At some point, you shouldn't be driving anymore. But for Grandpa and his Buick, man, good luck.
Yeah.
So the shorter renewal cycle, you said when your system comes in, is that 20, I should know this, right? 2018.
Mm-hmm.
So we could offer, if you looked at legislation 2018, and would that be... Could that be made cost neutral,
I think? We could, I mean, what we would do is just charge them a per year fee, which would be the same. It would be cost neutral then.
Okay.
So they just pay it, instead of paying $54, they would just pay the per year fee.
So that'd
be $9 or
be
$18, which probably would be a lot more cost effective for them.
Yeah,
to not have to pay
sense.
The whole thing at one time.
More saying the staffing resources, just increase the volume of in-office
right.
visits.
It's not...
That, but it's small populations. So.
And we're also looking at that for offender
yeah.
cards, too, to be able to do... We have to have statute authority to do something less
sure.
than 6 years. But that's a saving, you know, it's still cost neutral, but it helps them be able to come up with the money. Instead of $54, you come up with $9 or $18, right?
Yes. Yeah.
You have a great idea over here.
I think the concern where a lot of the people want their ID is to make sure that they can still fly if they're going to visit grandkids or something like that. So it'd be real important to make sure that whatever kind of ID they had that would comply with, you know, I mean, I understand we've got some issues about enhanced driver's license and those kind of things. So just making sure that we don't do a fix on one part of it and have to still not meet the needs of...
And there are enhanced driver's licenses and enhanced IDs, so they would have that capability. Again, that actually, the enhanced has even more costs associated with it. There are other ways that they could address it through passport or other forms of identification that are federally compliant. And then we don't know what will happen in this coming session, the potential of some sort of other legislation. Senator King is actually proposing a two-tier system, so I'm sure it's going to be a discussion in this upcoming session on how to be compliant.
Passports are even more expensive, though. So
now, with the increase in the enhanced driver's license, they're pretty much a wash.
Yeah.
It's pretty much, I can't remember the exact, within dollars of each other.
It's $130 for a passport.
Passport's good.
It's, what is it, $108 for EDL for 6 years versus 10 years.
So what's an enhanced driver's license? I don't know.
An enhanced driver's license is part of an agreement that we had through the Western Hemisphere for travel to Canada or Mexico by land or sea, not by air.
Okay.
And you have to be a U.S. citizen, which is different than the requirements of an EDL. A Real ID. Real ID only requires you to be here legally in the United States. It doesn't require you to be a U.S. citizen.
Yeah, I have a daughter that doesn't drive. She's 26, and she has the state ID, and that was fine with her birth certificate to get a passport. There was no issue.
Mm-hmm.
It's had the current address on it.
We have, I think you'll have a two-sided one-pager. We have additional research available that we'd be happy to share with any of you.
So, Brady, we need to move on. Next up on the agenda is the Strategic Highway Plan with Mike Gable.
Good morning, everybody. I'm Mike Gable. I'm Program Manager here at the Traffic Safety Commission, and I've been serving as the Project Manager for the Strategic Highway Safety Plan Target Zero Update Project for the last 16 months, and I'm so excited to be here today to officially present you with this plan. So welcome new commissioners, and so long to those of you that are leaving the commission. But I've got a handful of slides that I'm going to go through to walk you through the process, the project, and the progress that we've made so far. To start off with, just to remind you what the Target Zero Strategic Highway Safety Plan is all about, this Target Zero plan is designed to be a statewide plan that reaches many, many people and provides them a common language, common strategies, common priorities that they can use across the state in whatever area of traffic safety that you're involved in. You can use this plan as a guide to allow you to improve the traffic safety in whatever area is applicable to you. It's written for state agencies. It's written for local agencies, counties, county works commissions, county law enforcement, cities, communities, and private and nonprofit organizations also. So it's written for a wide variety of traffic safety partners. In addition to that, it is written to include statewide priorities. These are the priority areas that as we've looked at the data, analyzed the data, dug down into the data, these are the areas that we've come up with that should be the priority areas that the state, that this plan, through the partnership of all of your the folks that are involved in the plan, that they recommend be the priority areas for improving traffic safety in our state, and in particular, getting to zero traffic deaths and serious injuries by the year 2030. So it does include fatality data and serious injury data. And then as the plan digs down, it not only provides the priority areas, but it also provides researched strategies, recommended proven strategies that we can use in all of those areas that I talked about to target areas where we can use our scarce resources to the best use, provide the greatest return on our investments, and ultimately save lives and prevent those crashes. So how the plan has developed over the years, why did we do the plan in the first place? We do the plan in the first place because there's a federal requirement that says we will. The Federal Highway Administration provides guidance that says that the Strategic Highway Safety Plan has to be updated every 5 years. Here in Washington State, we like to update it every 3 years because, as you know, the world changes rapidly and is changing rapidly around us. The data changes rapidly, and so we take a look at the last 2 years worth of 3 years worth of data, and so we update that plan every 3 years to keep the data fresh and particularly to keep the strategies fresh. So this is where we've been with the Target Zero Strategic Highway Safety Plan. In the year 2000, we first adopted that zero goal for the state, the zero deaths across the state. 7 years later, we updated that strategic plan, and then we established we more clearly established the work around priorities, trend lines, and establishing goals to meet that zero deaths goal. In 2010, we updated the plan again on that three-year cycle. Set that three-year cycle in 2010, and there we took a closer look at the methods that we used to set the goals in the plan, and also then there was a larger, more enhanced collaborative tribal involvement in that particular update. In 2013, we updated the plan again. This time we approached it under a more organized, formal project team approach, and which we believe increased the collaboration in the plan. So for 2016, 2015, here we are again. This time we've continued that formal project team approach. We expanded that approach a little bit, made it more formal with some more formal documents that we introduced into the project. But most importantly, we updated the data. We've updated the format of the plan, as you'll see. We've updated the strategies in the plan. And this year we added something new. Under the guidance of Don Peterson from the Federal Highway Administration, we introduced a report that includes an analysis of using the Federal Highway Administration model evaluation. And basically that's a self-assessment that we do of the process that we use to update the plan. And we just this week presented that report and the plan to the Federal Highway Administration for their approval process. So how does the project look? Now this is the part that that is important to you. We set it up to be as collaborative as possible and as inclusive as possible as we develop this plan. We started off thinking about the Traffic Safety Commission and what the representation that you would want on the team, and so we basically broken it up into several groups and several teams. We start off with we had two project co-sponsors. John Nisbet, the Washington State Director of Traffic Operations, is one of our co-sponsors, along with Chris Medill, our Deputy Director here at the Traffic Safety Commission. And they guided this project, and they put this project together to ensure that that we would do a quality job at getting the project done. So then we put together a steering committee. And the steering committee has representatives from all of your areas on it, representing you and other interested parties too. And this was a formal steering committee, and this formal steering committee provided guidance to the whole team on the approach that we took. They provided the resources of the members that were on the other parts of the team. They provided the communication for us. They provided guidance and approval of the document as it came together. They reviewed and approved the strategies the priorities as they were developed. They approved the emphasis areas. They were presented and approved the data as the group developed it and analyzed it. So they've taken a role of guiding and approving this process and the document as it's been put together. Along with on that steering committee, this time we included some advisory members, sort of non-voting members, if you will, and they included folks like the Federal Highway Administration, Max Severide, who's on the phone with us from NHTSA Region 10, Federal Motor Carrier Safety Administration, Administrator of the Courts, and other advisory members to help guide this process. We also had a data analyst group, DAG, and a project team. That was a smaller core group. Now, those were the ones that rolled up their sleeves and really went to work and built this plan. They're the ones who held a number of meetings and wrote the plan, devised the plan, advised, and collaborated on the plan. And then we had a group of partners, and the partner group was a large group, and they were involved in the development plan in several ways that I'll talk about shortly. But that included representatives from all over the state government, all the tribal nations, local law enforcement, regional agencies and organizations, and private and nonprofit organizations. So these groups all came together, and this is the process that we followed. These were our milestones, and this is the chart that I've been using as we went along. But way back 16 months ago or so, back in March and April of 2015, we put this project team together. And that project team came together, and they developed the project plan, and it looks like this. I brought it with me to probably show you the hundreds of action items that we set forth that we would get done as we develop this project. So they put together this plan. They put together a schedule. They started looking at the data analyst group in particular under the co-lead of Matthew Enders over at WashDOT and Stacy Hoff here at Traffic Safety Commission. Started analyzing the data and looking at the priorities and seeing what that meant to us. Going into the summer and into the fall of last year, that team started looking at the document format and the proposed content of the document, and we started selecting writing teams. During those months, we've held 14 project team meetings, 4 steering committee meetings, lots and lots of subgroup and data analyst group meetings, sponsor meetings with the co-sponsors, and then weekly meetings between me as the project manager and the administrative sponsor, Chris Medill. We've had plenty of those meetings. So that all occurred as we went along through July into October. The preliminary, we ended up with a preliminary update of all the data and the charts to kick us off and really writing it. Stacy and her group accomplished that last fall and sort of set us up for the partners meeting. Now, the partners meeting is the first effort that we had to involve all of those various partners across the state. We held the partners meeting on December 8th, and that partners meeting was held at Great Wolf Lodge. and was attended by about 180 traffic safety partners from all over the state, and they included all of those groups that I pointed out earlier. And it was kicked off with really dynamic presentations by the Secretary of Transportation and our director and Director Kohler and Chief Batiste, and they kicked off this meeting, and we spent the day looking at the data, digging into the data, showing the data to our traffic safety partners, talking about the new priorities and sort of orienting them to this new document that we were creating. Then we spent the afternoon with them. We broke into smaller groups and spent the afternoon really digging down, looking for strategies, talking about strategies in two of our highest, most contentious areas for traffic safety right now, and that's speeding and distracted driving. Then late in the day, the last thing we did in that day was we took a look at traffic safety messaging and allowed the whole group to give us their thoughts on the various traffic safety messages and what they thought of those. And many of you were here in the room were at that partners meeting, and I appreciate you coming. Many of you in the room here today are on these teams that I just talked about, on the steering committee or the project team or the data analyst group, and some of you have dual roles like Dolly Fernandez. She serves on the project team, also on the steering, ended up also on the steering committee. So some of you have dual roles in that. So after that partners meeting, then the team really got busy. And starting in January of this year, we began to bring the document together. The teams were writing the chapters. The data got finalized. We started building the SHSP that you see in front of you. And then through the winter into spring, into the summer, we created this draft for review. And the way we worked the draft is with the writers would write it. We'd shoot it off to other reviewers to review the draft. We took some informal approach to that where we just showed it to people. We sent it to people by email. We took comments, handwritten comments in some regard. We also had a formal process where we had all of the chapters, the document available on Dropbox, and which allowed any of the team members and anybody that they solicited to come into the Dropbox and review those chapters. We got lots and lots of feedback on those chapters through that process. That was a pretty successful process. Then finally, we brought the draft SHSP together. We put it out there for official public comment, public and tribal comment, a 45-day official period that we had it out there for review and feedback. And the way we did that is we built a formal survey gizmo process to allow the public, anybody that wanted to view the document and provide us comments in the survey. And the survey was twofold. The survey allowed us to take their comments on what they thought about the plan and the usefulness of the plan, but also to provide us specific written feedback on any detail they wanted on any particular parts. And so we gathered that feedback, took that feedback, rolled it back in, working with the writers, and then got the official project team. Earlier this month, we got the official project team approval for the final document to send it to the steering committee, and we got the steering committee's approval to present it to you for your approval. And so that's where we stand on the document today. Couple of things that that are changed in the document, in the previous document. It has a few new chapters. We added a legislative and policy chapter to help us focus the effort of legislators to those particularly hard traffic safety areas that we want to emphasize. And so we brought that together. Director Kohler mentioned that changing culture is an important element in changing behaviors, and so that's absolutely true. This year we added a improving traffic safety culture chapter, which sets us up for the future to be able to implement strategies toward changing the traffic safety culture behaviors across the state. We introduced a new technology and traffic safety chapter, which is aimed, with all the changes, recent changes to vehicle technology lately, automated cars, vehicle safety, backup cameras, other vehicle safety items. We thought it was time to sort of introduce that as a new topic. So there's a new chapter on that. And then there's an important chapter that we've added on evaluation and diagnostics. Evaluation, analysis, and diagnostics. We added a chapter on that because everybody's recognizing the importance of not just having the plan, but also then using the plan and evaluating how you're doing within that plan. So that chapter also sets us up for the future to be able to do that. We also included this time some new infographics that look like this that you'll find in almost all in all the major chapters and sprinkled throughout the document. And this is a real drill down by the data group around the factors that overlap in a crash. So as we get more sophisticated in analyzing the data, now we're able to say, okay, in a crash that involves impairment, what percentage of those crashes also involve young drivers or motorcycles or unrestrained drivers? And so we've been able to implement this further drill down of the data in this new plan. So that's where we're at on the plan. Now this plan, what I pictured when I was 16 months ago when I started this, that I'd be standing here before you today and I'd be handing you a plan with a big bow on it. And that's not what you have. What you have is a plan. The reality of it is, in a plan like this, there's some things you just have to finalize as you bring it together. And that's where we're at. We're looking for your approval of this plan so that we can go forward and finalize it. And by finalizing it, there's a handful of things we still need to do that's not in this plan. I thought you might want to know what those are. First of all, there's a governor's letter. We send it to the governor. We ask for his support. He signs the letter and puts it in the plan. That's not in there yet. We need your approval to send it to the governor. There's a Traffic Safety Commission signature sheet. That's not in there yet that we're gathering. We have some special thanks that we give to the people that were involved in the plan. And that's one thing that's not in there. One thing we've added this year is an additional resources appendix where we have created links to all the other plans that are out there and all of the studies and reports that are applicable to traffic safety. And we're still tweaking that and making sure we have all the things in there that we want in there. And then we're still proofreading the plan. It's been proofread for several months now, and we're down to the wire on doing final proofread of the plan and a few final details that were to some data, specifically in the pedestrian chapter that we're tweaking with help of WSDOT and some language paragraph or two in the pedestrian chapter that we're tweaking. So that's what we're down to on the plan. So with that said, do you have any questions or comments about the project or the process or where we're at today? Yes, ma'am.
I just want to thank you, Mike, and all the people that worked on this plan. I got a chance to look at it, and Brady's been keeping me posted on it. It's an incredible work product, and I just want to compliment you and your leadership and all the people that helped you to put this together.
Thank you very much. I want to say thank you to you and your staff members and your partners that have come together to make this happen, because this was a really large team effort that we brought together. Other questions or comments? Okay. Thank
With
you
that,
very much.
Well, do you want a motion? Isn't there an action? Do you want a motion?
We were just having a discussion about marijuana and any effects associated with inclusion in this plan.
Stacey, you want to talk about that?
Oh, no. Stacey, I'm just looking at your symbols. I understand driving distracted, unrestrained, unlicensed, and drowsy. This is on page 39. But under drug and under impairment, you have a little drug bottle, which I'm thinking is Benadryl, and then the bottle, which I'm thinking is alcohol. Are you lumping marijuana into the whole drug with the prescription?
It is mentioned in the impairment chapter, but our message from the beginning is that it's not about marijuana driving,
right.
It's about drug driving.
Okay.
So it is more encompassing. But I do believe there is some information about 502.
Yeah, I'm sure there is, but I was just looking at your symbols as you go on.
We talk about drugged driving.
Drugged driving.
Which marijuana driving is
right.
a part of. So
okay.
Our big emphasis is to make sure people are not forgetting that there's a bigger problem than marijuana on our roadways.
Right. Right, there's Benadryl and everything else.
There's Benadryl,
right.
There's methamphetamine,
or
there's
opioids,
heroin,
yeah.
whatever
right.
you can think of.
Okay,
yeah.
That was just a clarity. The other thing I wanted to mention, I don't know if you have it in this book, and it's a common mistake, and I'll wave my little flag. But the Kalispell-Kaikum Council of Governments is a regional government like Thurston Regional, Puget Sound, and you had it under the tribal section. It is two tribal names in the old one. I don't know if you've even put a list like that, but that needs to be moved over. It's a regional government. It's an MPO, RTPO.
That's one of the pieces. It's not in there. We're tweaking that particular piece.
Okay. I'll make sure that gets moved over to the regional government.
That's part of what we're tweaking in this last minute is to make sure all of those details are as correct as they can be.
Right. That was the only thing I was really looking at. I went, oh, okay. No, that's wrong. But it's understandable the way you could make that mistake if you're not familiar with the area.
Great. Thank you. Other questions or comments?
I would just say tremendous work by everybody that's involved. I mean, we have evolved over the last 16 years through these Target Zero plans, and to be able to see the level of detail, and, I mean, you're trying to make it so that it's not so overwhelming but yet informative and useful for everybody. So, Director Kohler, thank you for letting us steal. I keep stealing from all of your agencies, but we really appreciate Mike taking the lead on this. John is part of the steering committee. Chris Medill is part of the steering committee, the chairs of that, and the process that they've gone through, because this has been a lot of work, and we really appreciate everything that you've done to get it to this point, so now the commissioners can...
So, Darren, do we need a motion to move this to the governor for approval?
Yes.
So can I have a motion to...
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Anyone opposed?
Great job.
Thanks
right.
so much.
Good job. Last on the agenda is the director's report by Darren.
I know that we're over time, but just a couple things that I wanted to just point out. We've already introduced Geneva, but I don't know, Bob, did we introduce you last time?
I wasn't there last time.
So we'll introduce you now. Bob Thompson, retired captain from the Puyallup Police Department. Chief Jeter and I have spoken. He's forgiven me for stealing Bob. But really appreciate Bob's going to come in as our statewide law enforcement liaison, being able to really look at and help us to work with our local law enforcement liaisons, as well as us doing some assessments with some of the local agencies and helping us to get a better idea of how we can help the local agencies in those regards. So thank you very much for being a part of the team.
Thank you.
So the other thing is, just so that you're aware, we are the NHTSA Region 10, which is Oregon, Washington, Alaska, Montana, and Idaho. The region administrator, John Moffitt, just retired. We are currently a region acting administrator, and that's Chris Murphy from California. So just so that you're aware that change has been made. Is that okay, Max?
Yes.
Perfect. Just wanted to let you know that, you know, our Tribal Traffic Safety Advisory Board is still operating. We're still moving, and many of you may have seen some of our videos that we've put out on the tribal issues, as well as now focusing on a video that has just come out about protecting our past and protecting the future. Yes. Yesterday we had a great opportunity to be on a webinar, on a national webinar with law enforcement liaisons across the country, and got to share some of the successes that we've had with the tribes and the things that we've been doing. MJ is our coordinator, and really appreciate what we've been able to do with the tribes. We've seen the video with the National Congress of Native Americans, and also with the American Tribal Northwest, ATNI. I always get that mixed up.
National Congress of American Indians.
Right, we get that
affiliated
one.
Affiliated tribes
of the Northwest Indians, which is about 5 states of tribal electives. And so being able, because we see from that is our number one priority, is being able to get the data that we need in order to provide and assist them. Our highway safety plan has been submitted. We're just waiting now for approval from NHTSA. The highway safety plan is our formal request to NHTSA for the funds that you approved back in April. They have a 45-day review period, and then once we get that back, those grants would then be authorized October 1st of 2017. For planning purposes, we will be putting out announcements in December of 17 for the 18 grants. I mean, it's we're moving that quickly. I know many of you are planning to, just as a reminder, August 27th through the 31st, the Governor's Highway Safety Association Annual Conference at the Sheraton in Seattle, we're hosting. We're hoping to have the video from the governor, and we have some great, we have 17 different breakout sessions. It's going to be a fabulous conference. They have actually exceeded the room block for this conference. They are exceeding where they were at registrations almost at every conference, so we're very excited. Many people are excited to come to the Northwest, period. But our keynote speaker on Wednesday, Chief, is Bill Walton. Mm. So,
haven't seen him since I played against him.
That Bill Walton.
Yeah.
So what'll be great is you'll have somebody you can actually stand and look eye to eye to.
Oh, no, he's much bigger than me.
So with cool. that, appreciated all the work that our staff does every day. They do some tremendous work. A lot of effort that goes into that. But and I just want to thank them. So a round of applause for them. So I know we're short of time, but I just wanted to say thank you to a couple of our partners that have been with us through some hard times, through some great times, but making traffic safety our number one goal and being able to push things forward. And Sandy, we're going to miss you a lot. So thank you. For traffic safety excellence, and appreciate all you're going to do. And I know that you'll be probably helping us a lot with your policy directions and things in New York.
You can always call me.
Alan, congratulations.
Hey, thank you.
You're going to reach retirement. I know you're not a formal commissioner, but you have been here almost tirelessly working with us through a lot of thick and thin. So I just wanted to give
you a lot of years.
Yes, it has. And appreciate everything that you've done.
Thank you. Thanks for the great work you all do.
Thanks for helping me write the school
Darren?
Bus
chapter. Yes. Oh, you need to read that.
I know, I'm going to. That's
okay.
Why I was wanting to know if you were
all
done.
All right, and with that, and the one thing is Alan and Sandy are leaving, but also we have just received an announcement of somebody else that's leaving. MJ, would you like to stand just for a second? We'll put her on the spot. MJ has determined that now she's going to enter that land of retirement. And so we congratulate her on her next journey in this. And so her last day will be August 31st.
August 31st, yes.
So we have lots of things coming your way for that. So we appreciate it. So thank you very much. With that, I'll turn back to you.
So I neglected to read in for the record, but I wanted to read a letter that comes from Roger Millar. He was unable to attend today because of a previous commitment, but he is fully supportive of approving the 2016 Target Zero plan and wanted that reflected in the minutes. He extends his apologies and wants to share that Target Zero is a compelling goal. He appreciates the commitment of revising the Target Zero for every 3 years. It gives us a chance to pause, review our progress, consider emerging trends, and commit to doing our best to reduce and eliminate serious and fatal injury traffic collisions. Target Zero also guides WSDOT efforts in targeting our resources for safety improvements. I fully support approving the 2016 Target Zero plan with the pending revisions. Sincerely, Roger Millar, Acting Secretary of Department of Transportation. So just wanted that reflected in the minutes, and I forgot to do that when Mike was going through that process. So with that, Darren, you're completed with your report, right?
Yes.
So with that, I'd like a motion to adjourn.
So moved.
Second.
All in favor? Anyone opposed? All right.
Thank you, everyone.
So when did you play against Walt?
WSU.
You played WSU?
It was
Brad Jackson. He was I saw you play Far West Classic. I saw you play. Yeah, we. That's back when the Far West Classic was a big deal. I was 2 years old and graduated 2 years before I was president, quarterback, basketball.
Yeah, he's up to UW.